Welcome to The Revenue Architects. I'm your host, Jeff Ignacio. In this podcast, we're going to bring incredible business athletes together. We'll explore how to build a go-to-market capability for businesses, no matter the size or shape. We'll remix content from a bunch of different places, bring in guests, deep dive into incredible topics. So with that in mind, I want to thank you for joining us. And now on to this episode of The Revenue Architects. We have Pete Pizzangi joining us today. I first met Pete when I was living in San Francisco. We met at a Modern Sales Pro event, and I had just broken into sales ops when I joined the Modern Sales Pros. So I was really keen to meet the members of my local chapter there in San Francisco. I remember Pete as the man who asked for open feedback on his book, Founding Sales. I believe it was this rather extensive Google Doc. And I didn't know how books were published, but it seemed like that's how the pie was made. So crowdsourcing go-to-market wisdom at its finest. And so to me, you know, Pete the legend in building what a community is all about with the rise of micro communities, especially during the pandemic. Modern Sales Pros, pointing back to those years when I met people in person, was very near and dear to my heart. So a brief introduction of Pete. He was a founder of TalentBin, which was then acquired and sold to Monster.com. Also the founder of Modern Sales Pros. If you're not a member, I encourage you to join. He's also the founder of his current venture, Atrium, which you can visit at atriumhq.com. And since I've said all that, I'd like to call him also the protector of the realm. So Pete, welcome to the show.
Super stoked, Jeff. I'm glad you're doing this. You have so much sales ops knowledge to share with the world. This is another format by which you do. Although you pretty much killed the LinkedIn game. So I think the bar is kind of high, man. We're going to see if we can reach it.
All right. Yeah, for sure. I feel like the LinkedIn thing is the more recent invention. You may know Justin Welsh online. He's a former boss of mine, and he posts every single day, and I kind of ridiculed him for it because I thought, hey, you're like competing with your company brand. This whole idea of a personal brand seemed way too different for someone like him. But yeah, totally embraced it, loved it. But let's talk about you. So you've gone through a couple of ventures with TalentBin, yep, and with Atrium. And so as a founder, you know, it's one thing to join a startup. It's one thing to build it. I'd love to hear from you. You know, what does that go-to-market engine look like? You know, are you thinking about that first, or are you just starting to solve product market fit?
Yeah. So the way to think about it is there's definitely like a stepwise process there. And I have a deck that I present on this quite a bit called founder-led selling. If you're people who are listening, just Google founder-led selling, they'll find like some stuff on YouTube and other places where I've presented it. But it's really like there's a series of kind of initial steps that need to be taken where if you kind of get out ahead of your skis, it's going to be a problem. Like if you try to go to market with something where you actually haven't, where you don't know exactly what the problem is that you're solving, or moreover, you haven't proven that the thing in question delivers utility, you might be able to sell it, but you're probably not going to deliver utility, and you're probably going to have a churn problem, right? So the stages there is kind of the first stage is, do we know what problem we're solving, right? And do lots of people have it? The mechanism by which you validate that is customer interviews. So for the people who are listening, who maybe are more on the sales side of the house, way to think about a customer interview is it's kind of like a disco call or like the discovery part of a sales conversation, but then there's no pitch. Like you're just doing disco. And so it's really just focusing in on like, do you have this problem? Like I hypothesize that you have this problem. Do you have it? How do you solve it right now? What's unsatisfactory about that? Can you quantify how unsatisfactory that is? How have you tried to sell it? And like, you know, how big of a pain is this for you from a prioritization standpoint? If you do that, then you kind of earn the right to progress to like trying to build something to solve that, right? That's like the way that startups kill themselves is by solving a problem that people don't really necessarily have. That's the kind of the first thing. And like Paul Graham talks about this, like build something that people want, right? So the way that you do that is not necessarily to say like, hey, I have this idea that like something that would be helpful for me. You have to validate that lots of people have those. That's the first step. And the next step is build something, you know, ideally in a minimally viable capacity that demonstrates that you can use technology. You can use technology in some sort of capacity in order to resolve this problem and deliver utility to the customer in question. And so, and of course, that's like early product development. And so what you're trying to do there is just demonstrate that this thing that you've built helps one of those KPIs that you're trying to resolve there. And so the best way, of course, of doing that is really, you know, it's in B2B sales, or sorry, B2B software beta. You know, beta is really great there, and one of the things that can happen here is you can join these things together. So say you do like 50 or 100 customer interviews with like your target market. Well, some of those people are going to be really excited about the fact that you're trying to solve this problem. And if you're able to like aggregate together 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 of those folks to kind of bring along with you and be beta customers, well, now you're in a really great spot, right? And so then once you've demonstrated proof of utility, right? Like, let's use some examples here. So like, you know, use Atrium as an example, right? We make data-driven sales management software that's like extraordinarily easy to set up. And it takes 90 seconds to turn on, and lo and behold, sales managers, SDR managers are managing their teams with data. Okay, great. So what we would want to prove is that, hey, you turn this on, and then lo and behold, sales managers are managing their SDR teams better, and opportunity creation goes up, right? Or activity levels go up, or whatever. Those would be the KPIs. Same with like upkeep, right? You can like, oh, you know, the time it takes to send a work order or whatever goes down by this amount of time, et cetera. So you'd want to prove that utility. So then, because once you've done that and you've proven that utility, well, guess what? Now we can charge for it, right? Because you can quantify it and say like, hey, look, let's use upkeep as an example. We're saving you this amount of time, and your field reps or your field service personnel are able to do like this many more visits in a day as a result of that. And so, you know, in aggregate across like the 20 field service reps that you guys have, you know, over a year, that adds up to like, you know, $300,000 of extra field service that's getting done. Cool. You should pay us 50 grand for that. And they're like, yeah, you know what? You're right, Jeff. I should. Right. And so like at that point, that's where, you know, like that's the point at which you want to start doing what I call like early stage founder led selling, or have initial proof of like value exchange, where we're giving you this software or this solution, you're giving us this money back, it's a fair trade, you're happy, I'm happy, you're getting to success, you're retaining and expanding and referenceable, et cetera. And so it's really at that stage, that's the point at which it's like, okay, cool, this stuff's working. Now we can build that engine, right? Now, maybe now we can have 2, 3, 6, 10 account executives. And that's when like optimizing the go-to-market becomes a more important thing, as opposed to literally figuring out, can this even be brought to market? Is it delivering utility?
A lot to unpack there. And one, I appreciate you giving Upkeep a shout. For folks who are listening, Upkeep is the company I work at. We're the number one CMMS system plug. But a lot to unpack here. A couple of things. I love the idea of a customer interview. I find that, you know, a little paradoxical with some folks saying, build something for people who may not even know what they're looking for. So on the other side, what also works is, why not have a conversation? Because misery loves company. What pains or ails someone might just spill out of their mouth, and you might be able to pattern match from those conversations and then build from there. I find a dichotomy a little bit with pattern matching, because you find trend. And then as you're starting to build, you famously hear startups making the big old P, the pivot. And so, you know, I'm curious, you know, have you had to face a pivot with your product market fit at times, whether that was Talent Bin or Atrium? And if you did, how'd you know that you needed to make that pivot?
Yeah. So I think just to go back to the first thing that you had mentioned around building things that people don't necessarily know that they want versus, you know, them telling you what they want. There's a little bit of a subtle distinction there, because there's the joke where, you know, the Henry Ford joke, if I asked customers what they, or if I asked my customers what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse, right? And that's fine, right? But like, just because somebody wants a faster horse doesn't necessarily mean that you have to build them a faster horse, right? Because what they're saying is like, I would like to get places faster, right? And so the important, and this there's a sales lesson here too, which is it's about asking people what their problems are and what's problematic about them, and like, you know, and how they've tried to solve them, Because then if you can show them a new way to solve that, like, well, you know what? I don't have a faster horse for you, man, but I got this thing right here and it'll get you places. It'll get you to the grocery store and it doesn't poop everywhere. What do you think about that? Right. So I think like talking with people, like doing customer interviews is required. You don't have to take as like gospel what the person, what the customers are saying, because that's your situation. Like that's your thing. You're the technologist. Like, you know, oh, you're asking for a better horse because you don't understand internal combustion engines and metallurgy, but I do. Right. So, right. Like, and that's the kind of thing that I like, they bring the pain to the party. You bring the solution to the party. So that's like one thing I would think about there. In terms of pivots. Yeah. I mean, like our last software company, we had a pretty big pivot. And usually where that comes from is oftentimes insufficient customer, like insufficient customer research is usually the kind of the crux, especially in B2B is usually the crux of that. So at TalentBin, we started as a company called honestly.com that was trying to do community generated reputation, kind of like Yelp, but for professionals, right? So instead of it like being Glassdoor, we're going to review this company. Instead, this was like, it was like community source performance reputation for individuals. At the time, it was like very controversial. But the funny thing was, is that like the problem wasn't that people like left bad reviews or negative reviews or incorrect reviews or whatever. It was just that like nobody cared.
Right? Imagine that, Yelp reviews getting scrubbed or people just waxing and waning over it.
Yeah, it's just like people just didn't care, right? Like they got more important things to do. And so that was fine, right? And so largely the reason why was because we didn't go about things and like, you know, test it in a minimally viable way to see like, hey, would people like actually leave anonymized reviews over the phone? It's like people got too much stuff to get to, man. Like they got Instagram to check out or like, you know, Twitter to goof off on, or I guess LinkedIn to goof off on now. And so what we did was we pivoted to TalentBin, where what we were like, okay, well, we're trying to help people hire better. So, you know, in this case, we were thinking about reputation and kind of like, you know, background and what have you, like background checking. And so we're like, okay, well, what about like the top of the funnel? So we ended up talking with a bunch of recruiters and saying like, hey, what are your biggest challenges around hiring? And they're like, well, you know, my biggest problem is like, you know, software engineering hiring is my biggest pain. Oh yeah. What's the big problem around that? Oh man. Just like getting people to like, you know, finding the relevant people, engaging with them, communicating with them by email and getting them to respond to us is really problematic. Oh, okay, interesting. How do you do that right now? Well, you know, LinkedIn is super picked over. This was like 8 years ago, but like LinkedIn is super picked over and people have like really crappy profiles on there. So I'm going to use GitHub, right? So I go on to GitHub and you know, I try to find profiles of people who are contributors to different open source projects and what have you. And then I try to find their, you know, I try to find their email address. Oh, okay. Well, that sounds like a lot of work. Like how many of those are you able to do an hour? I don't know, like 3. Jeez. Right. Like, yeah, but it's kind of worth it because nobody else is on there. And then moreover, you know, nobody responds to LinkedIn emails anyway, but they respond to their email address. Okay. Interesting. Well, what if we crawled all of GitHub and put it in a database and made it such that you could search it. And then we put like a little bit of like recruitment marketing automation, kind of like drip marketing email on top of that. Would that be useful? Hell yeah, that'd be useful. All right, cool. Right. And so like that was so that and that and that's what eventually we made with TalentBin, right? Where we crawled GitHub and Stack Overflow and Meetup and Stack, and Twitter and all these different places where people engage in professional behavior as well and created like a database of that. And so like as a result of these customer interviews, so like we pivoted. But really what we just did was we like went back and did the thing that we should have done from the get-go, right? Rather than building something that didn't necessarily like, wasn't solving the problem that people had.
Imagine right? that, so, a beautiful yeah. soup crawler on a place where folks are putting all their information, right? Because they're essentially contributing to open source projects and you can kind of prove the veracity of the quality of the software engineer to the code. That's unique. I was just thinking about the faster horse, and essentially it's, yeah. are you solving the right problem mm-hmm. or reframing? It reminds me of the story of the elevator maintenance company who receives a ton of complaints. Hey, this elevator is really slow. So yeah. the facilities management company comes in and installs a new mirror. And instantly all the complaints go away. So they just they just reshifted the problem. The problem wasn't that it was slow. They just hated being in the elevator staring off in the ether.
That's funny, man.
Yeah, vanity is an important thing. You can put a mirror in an elevator and everyone will be happy. So yeah. We talked about founder-led selling. I'd love to ask you, you know, when does the founder let go? When do they bring in an operator, a seller, as to say, what does that mean? Is it a VP of sales? Is it their buddy that they went to college with? You know, what does that mean?
Well, so when I talk about founder-led selling, and I talk about this in my book, Founding Sales, usually like the first person who should be selling the first couple dozen deals, it's really difficult for that. It can be done, but it's very difficult for that to be someone other than like a business founder, even a technical founder doing it. And the claim of my book is that anybody can do this because it's not magic, right? Sales is just a craft. You just have to learn it. It's not like pleasant to learn, right? It's kind of, it is different and new for a lot of people, but it's not black magic. And so that's kind of the claim. And the reason why is because as the founder, as like, you know, the person who is closest to the problem space and also, you know, closest to the problem space and comprehends most uniquely how the product has been designed in order to address the problems in question, the founder is very well suited to tell that story, right? And it's easier to get a founder to be able to minimally sell a handful of these things than it is to bring up a sales rep or a dedicated seller to understand the problem space. And also the other challenge too is that early on, like the product is not going to fit the market. So there needs to be a very compressed feedback loop between, oh yeah, I presented this thing and I tried to install it and I tried to get them to use it and it had these failures associated with it. I, as the product manager or the product owner or whatever, can see that and be like, oh yeah, you know what? It turns out this faster horse, we should probably put tires on it instead of hoofs on the four edges, like the four corners, because like it's not going fast enough. But you know what? Maybe we put tires on this, right? And so that would essentially be like a feature refinement or like bug removal or whatever. And so that feedback loop is of between like market interface and product is you want that to be as tight as possible early on. And so then though, once you get to the point where it's like, okay, look, I sold a half dozen of these. I sold a dozen of these. People are getting to success. They're highly referenceable. They're stoked. They're like, yeah, you know what? This is great. This is the bee's knees. You should talk to my buddy XYZ, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's the point at which you want to start bringing in some, because the way that sales organizations, the way that B2B organizations get the scale is not through just like magically selling more, like an individual selling like a bajillion deals. It's usually adding more humans who will then cap out at a certain number of deals that they're able to sell per week, per month, you know, per quarter, et cetera. And so the first step on the way to having, you know, the first step on the way to having 100 sales reps is to prove that you can have a sales rep, right? An additional sales rep who is not you, who is selling at least as well as you, right? And so that's really the point at which to engage in that. Now, in terms of like who that human is, you know, usually my recommendation there is to look for a rep with upside, right? So like look for more senior reps who are coming out of a category, like a startup in a category that's similar to yours. So a good example of this would be the prototypical example I always use is if you're starting a new HR tech company, or a new recruiting company or what have you, generally you would look at former reps or like reps who are at like Greenhouse or Lever or, you know, or fill in the blank, right? Because they're intimate with the space. They understand the sales, like the HR sales motion, et cetera, probably a similar ASP, probably a similar buyer persona, et cetera. And so like looking for those sort of reps who can come in, they're used to a little bit of like chaos. You're not expecting them to make up the sales motion because you already innovated that, right? Like you figured that out, but they're used to the sales deck being 10 slides, right? Not like 20 slides, and there's not a kill slide for everything and so on and so forth, right? So those are, that's usually the sort of pattern that I recommend. And then you get that person to success, you get others to success as well. And then, you know, in 18 months or 36 months or whatever, you've got your potential future sales managers dialed in there.
Now that's interesting, because you're looking for someone who knows the space, they got a little headspace, they're scrappy, they're not going to be this senior leader who comes in and expects a ton of collateral or decks or battle cards in place. Yeah. Interesting enough, you're looking, you know, you're talking about the ATS applicant tracking system space. Mm-hmm. They know the buyer because they've sold it before. Perhaps they have not been in the manager position, but they're hungry, right? They've had success where they were. So I actually think that makes a ton of sense. And so, you know, now that when we think about the founder becomes either this executive sponsor for your heavy hitting deals, coming in for that last mile, or they've become this epitaph to a, you know, a founder story that's baked and used over and over and over.
Right.
Let's talk about the operations space. When did you first notice that, you know, sales ops or marketing ops, whatever you want to call it, started becoming in vogue, at least in the SaaS space? And where have you seen its impact over the last, you know, couple of years?
Yeah. So where I became intimate with that was, one, after my Talent Bin, my last software company, was acquired by Monster, I was responsible for new product sales at Monster. So I went from having a 20-person sales organization at Talent Bin to working at a 1,000-person sales organization. And so really quickly, one of the things we identified was that in this very large sales organization, there was kind of like a low managerial comprehension of the quantity and quality of selling activity that was going on. And this was really frustrating to us, because we had been used to running a really tight shop at Talent Bin. And so, you know, quickly we identified that the sales operations role was responsible for that at Monster. The sales operations function at Monster was kind of like the older school rendition of sales operations. So more kind of like, hey, territory management or like compensation or whatever, versus like sales strategy and like a bunch of, you know, proactive analytics and, you know, service provision to the sales management, what have you. And so that was kind of like the first inkling. And then the second thing was, then when we started doing our customer research for Atrium, where we were like, man, there's gotta be an easier way for organizations to like instrument their sales teams and use data to manage their reps. As we were doing research and try to figure out who's responsible for this, who goes about this, and like, how do they do it? Well, very quickly we identified that like, that's where sales operations lived, right? And that was kind of like their bailiwick. And now obviously they had a bunch of challenges associated with it, because like, you know, traditional BI or, you know, horizontal BI is really, you know, very heavyweight and kind of fragile and requires, you know, it requires BI architects to create stuff for them. And then moreover, you know, managers are usually do a fairly poor job of consuming walls of charts, et cetera. But the pattern kept coming up and up. It was like, oh, okay. Yeah. You know, yeah, our sales operations function focused on that. You should go talk to so-and-so, like Doug Landis at, you know, at Box back in the day. I'm trying to think of the other kind of like sales ops folks. Alan Kobayashi, he was at Medallia at the time, had phenomenal conversation with him on how, you know, how they go about these things. Manish Jindal, who runs sales ops at Cloudflare. All of these were like really helpful initial conversations. And so we've seen it only grow since then. And that was actually one of the reasons why we created Modern Sales, because we're like, okay, there's this emerging class of like very data-driven, modern thinking sales operator who is sales operations largely, but then there's also sales managers and leaders who think in this way as well. Well, we should create a community to help them help each other, because this is an emerging space, and the more that they can chat with each other and kind of answer each other's questions, the faster everyone will learn, you know?
I think that makes sense. Part of it is thinking vintage sales ops. I'm thinking of sales planning, sales analysis, these old roles that were here, you know, 10 years ago. And you're right. I think they focused on service-based outcomes. So are we getting your territories shaped correctly? Yeah. Are we running a deal desk? So that way we can capture all non-standard items.
Yep.
And I guess when you think about the BI and the data visualization layer, you have these data scientists today, which is, you know, a powerful function, but but yet they lack the business context. Mm-hmm. And then you have these sales reps who crossed over into ops, but perhaps lack the Salesforce systems administration and the data tool. So there's a blend between those two sets of skills and where folks come from. So, you know, we talk about, you know, art of sales and the science of sales. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Yeah. So I think that, so first of all, you're exactly right regarding like the tool set of the manager, or sorry, the sales operations person. Like, I think first of all, it's like emerging, right? You're like, you want just enough data analysis, just enough analysis, just enough strategy thinking, just enough potential CRM administrative capacity, just enough selling comprehension, right? Like, understand how SDRing works, understanding how closing works, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that like, so in baseball, there's like the phrase, like the five tool player, right?
You know, runs, that.
Right. Like, what is it? It's like runs, hits, fields, hits for power. And I forget what the fifth one is, but yeah. And so I think that the toolkit is kind of accretive right now. And then the other cool thing too, is that, like, you know, baseball has been around forever. There's not like new tools that you have to be good at showing up. Whereas in our case, like, new stuff showing up all the time. So we have to get good at figuring out, like, you know, acquiring those new skill profiles. So there's definitely that. But yeah, so I think that, like, the, you know, sales operations as a function is kind of like getting more mature over time. And yeah, and like, it's just like a constant evolution.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on moving from generalist down to specialization, because if I think about baseball, particularly regular season baseball, it's horrible to watch because everyone has an opener now. They go one inning, two innings, they bring in a parade of relievers, folks who went to AAA, AA, maybe just enough to make a couple hundred grand here and there. But we think about full cycle reps. We've truncated that front end cycle and brought in sales development reps. And yet we look at sales operations and they're handling everything, or marketing, whatever the title is. They're taking the handoff from marketing all the way to sales execution to new customer acquisition. Do you think there's a place for specialization with sales development operations, middle funnel operations? I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, totally, man. And like, yeah, and really where that comes from is, like, the only place where you're going to be able to do that is in larger organizations. But yeah, for sure. Like, one of the early customer interviews that we did was at LinkedIn. So we talked with Brian Frank, who used to run sales operations at LinkedIn, about what we were doing or what we were thinking about doing at HRM. He's like, oh yeah, this is great. And he had us like go off and talk to like five other people. And one of them was this guy named Declan McKiernan, I want to say. Definitely Declan. He had like obviously a delightful Irish last name as well. And he was delightful and had an amazing Irish accent. But he focused on SDR ops, right? And was specialized. Now, LinkedIn's a big organization. So usually where you see that sort of specialization in earlier stage operations functions is, you know, like more junior operations folks, like junior operations wood choppers who are peeling off some of the more rote behavior. So, like, you know, deal desk. Right, like deal desk is getting a junior person to just do deal desk and run. Like, we use RevOps as our CPQ, and it's great. But like, I still am like deal desk for my reps, because I only have six reps right now, and I want to make sure that like things don't get messed up. And so like that's a good example. Or like, you know, having somebody who maybe is like a dedicated analyst who like has some CRM admin, can do your data loading, can do your data cleaning, et cetera, et cetera. And that way you can spend your time doing board deck preparation, or, you know, getting in fights with marketing around like the definition of, you know, what's actually an MQL, what's actually an SQL, et cetera, et cetera. Like those kind of higher value things. So I think just usually what ends up happening is specialization starts out with like task load, kind of taking the lower value tasks, not dissimilar to SDR, right? The whole idea around SDR AE is you're taking the lower value tasks, or a task that can be done, you know, both by a more junior person and a more senior person, and you're doing specializations such that only the junior person is doing that at a lower cost, which ideally the more senior person is spending their time on higher output activities. Not always the case necessarily. They might be spending their time kind of golfing instead because they're getting teed up by an SDR putting ops on their calendar, but that's not how it's supposed to work. But yeah, when you get into larger organizations, you definitely get, so usually the architecture there is a sales operations business partner architecture. So like LinkedIn had this, Box has had this, you get this at Salesforce, other places where it's like, hey, here's the sales operations manager. They're partnered with these four, you know, sales managers or these six sales managers or whatever your ratio is. And so usually that'll kind of get partnered up like, okay, this sales ops manager is focused on these four SDR managers or what have you. And of course they just become intimate with the challenges there. So that's one way of doing that. But even in larger organizations, you get kind of the specialization usually ends up being around kind of like task centric. So I know this because this is something that we deal with Atrium. Usually you don't get sales operations folks who are literally dedicated to the consumption and interpretation of performance metrics on behalf of managers until you get to very large sales organizations. And so it's funny, like in an organization where there's like 10 sales ops analysts who literally their only job is to like go through dashboards and spreadsheets and then like regurgitate insights to the managers. If that exists in an organization, usually we DQ it because we're like, all right, look, you already solved this with like a bunch of 24-year-olds. So we're not going to try to solve it with robots, which is kind of like how Atrium does it. So like go with God. Those are only in really large organizations. So usually what the specialization you see is more on those kind of like skill-based or like task-based as opposed to like category supportive space. Based.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense because when I was at Google, I was a specialist, right? Building comp plans, annual plans, territories,
sure. Courses,
and I covered two continents. That was it. And there were other folks doing the rest of the world, right? So I was one of an army of analysts, you know, basically covering the spectrum. It's interesting because the next move that I made was to be a team of one. And the incredible burden of being a team of one is you don't really know what you're getting yourself into until you do it. You get into that seed series A, maybe middle of your series B, and you're this team of one doing everything from task management all the way down to ticket support and all the way back up again an hour later to providing, you know, insights to the board.
Yeah, totally. Yep.
So I recommend your book, by the way, to almost anyone when it comes to, so I'd love to hear, you know, what have you learned since publishing your book and what would you kind of rewrite or add back in or take out? Like what's changed in the context of today?
Well, so when I wrote Founding Sales, I tried to write it. So the whole idea behind Founding Sales was back in like 2011 or 2012, when I was first doing founder selling myself for TalentBin, I went to go like read the book on it. I was like, oh, okay. I have to learn how to do sales. I'll just go read a book on how to do startup sales for non-salespeople. And there wasn't one. And I was like, oh, this is a problem. So I read like Predictable Revenue and I read, you know, the Challenger Sale and like Spin Selling, whatever, but they're all for kind of like more developed, further along organizations. Like Predictable Revenue is just about like SDRing, right? And so what ended up happening was I just kind of like learned through doing and through teaching from other entrepreneurs in the first round capital portfolio. So then when I went to write the book, I was like, look, I want to write this in a way where just it's like the concepts of selling, right? It's not like, hey, you immediately should buy Sales Loft or Outreach or whatever. It's like, it certainly talks about, you know, tooling. And of course, like tooling changes very quickly, but it talks more about like concepts, right? Like the concepts of discovery and finding user pain and then fitting your solution to it on a use case by use case value driver basis, or like talking about pipeline management, or talking about closing, talking about like objection handling, things like that. And that stuff doesn't really change very, very much. Definitely there's like new categories of things, right? Like I talked about RevOps earlier. Like there's a bunch of software that previously would have been like the province of much later stage organizations. Like, so when when Steel Brick was like the only game in town, you're not going to implement Steel Brick CPQ if you've got like five reps, because like, holy macaroni, it would take you so long. It would be such a pain in the ass. Like, you would never do it, right? You're going to wait until you have like a super high volume of quotes that have to go out, and which is usually like a way more reps. Nowadays, if you've got like easy in software, right? Like, you know, RevOps and other stuff, you might go and implement, you might implement CPQ way earlier, right? Or you might implement eSign way earlier because, you know, because it's gotten cheaper, it's gotten easier to install. So I think I would modify that a little bit, because the stack, like the stuff that like you can ingest into your stack early on is way more, has expanded. And so it makes sense. And part of this is like the rise of sales operations. Like, it makes sense to expand your stack earlier on to get yourself leverage, right? So I think that there's some kind of stuff there that I would add. The other thing that I would add is, you know, with the rise of PQL and kind of like easy in selling, or like easy in software that can install, people can get to utility early on or like quickly, and then sales gets involved. I don't really talk about that a ton in founding sales. I wrote an article recently on Lenny Ruchitsky's newsletter on layering sales into a self-serve B2B product. But I think that that's something that's really fascinating to me, around how direct sales plays in an environment where people can kind of light themselves up and get started. So yeah, like the Dropboxes of the world, the Slacks of the world, the Zooms of the world, et cetera, et cetera. So I probably would add more around that, because it really is a superpower, where instead of like getting an MQL coming in, right, we're like, hey, you should take a demo or whatever, you've got somebody who's in the product doing some stuff. Maybe they're stuck, right? And like, they need a little bit of like human help, or maybe they're jamming along great and we need to have a commercial conversation with them, right? So I think that that's like a frontier that is really an area of interest for me.
I love that. If you lead in with a free trial and somehow looking at your product logs and looking at daily active usage, it triggers to me. And if we can enrich your data with, hey, this person has a higher propensity to turning more than an SMB sale into an enterprise, let's involve a sales conversation. And guess what? You're a product expert, not a sales rep.
Yeah, totally. And like, that's a really great way of describing it. And that has actually been how like developer tools have been sold historically, like the Datadogs of the world, all going all the way back to like open source software. This is something David Skok from Matrix hit me to, because he's one of my favorite authors on modern go to market. And he was an early investor in JBoss. And he was taught, and he does a lot of writing on this, where it's more about like helping, like, hey, saw that you downloaded some documentations on JBoss, right? And I saw that you have a Lockheed Martin email address. Wow, I bet you guys have a lot of servers to run Java on, huh? Maybe we can talk about that. weird, huh? Right? Versus like, you know, someone downloading JBoss and they're like, you know, some undergrad at, you know, at Carnegie Mellon or whatever. It's like, all right, cool, you have fun with that. I'm not going to talk to you. Right?
Or to download an ebook 5 minutes later and SDR hits them up, schedules a meeting only to have the AE repeat the same exact questions that the SDR asked the day before. Sure. So I want to create a new segment. We call this the Rorschach test, or at least find some cognitive resonance here. I'll say a few words and I'd love to hear the first thing that comes to your mind. You know, I'll give an example, like MarTech consolidation. What would be the first word? So I'm going to go through this list and, you know, never proven this segment out. So let's see how this goes. You ready?
Yeah.
All right. Personalization versus relevance.
Both.
B2B versus B2C.
B2B.
MQL, real or not?
Yeah, properly enriched. Or sorry, like prop with the right metadata.
Deal velocity.
Instrumentation.
Enterprise pricing.
CPQ.
All right, we'll go with three more. So SDR is an inbound.
Instant response.
Pipeline management.
Dumpster fire.
Cold calling.
Just do it.
All right, cool. Yeah, think about my first cold call. I was in high school selling Cutco knives.
And they gave you, amazing. Yeah,
Have you ever owned a Cutco knife?
My wife's nephew sold Cutco knives, so my father-in-law has a bunch of them, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, I still have them. They're still sharp enough that I don't have to send them back to headquarters to get them sharpened. But I remember thinking, I've exhausted through my friends and family list of the first five people that they told me to go sell into. What should I do now? And Literally one of my friends said, you should just start cold calling people. I was like, well, what does cold calling mean?
You sold Cutco knives via telesales?
I tried to. I can tell you my ratios weren't very good. I had to come up with a new pitch. So we literally grabbed the phone book and I started off with the A's. Obviously everyone who's has a last name starting with A, you probably got called incessantly. And I just went out and did a cold call script on my Cutco knives. The rate was not very good. Yeah. It was a 1% or 2% pickup. And I was more interested in tracking my spreadsheet than I was actually selling. I think that's probably a precursor to moving into ops.
Yeah, fair enough. What was the average deal size on a Cutco transaction?
About $300, if I remember right.
No kidding.
Yeah, with inflation to today's dollars, it's probably $1 million.
Yeah, right. There you go. That's fascinating because I wonder if you could actually do SDRing. I wonder if you could abstract the Cutco go-to-market, like have inside reps calling in. Right, like maybe in like the Philippines or in like Pakistan or something like that, and then like essentially teeing up visits. It's like, hey, you know, do you have a knife problem, whatever? And then like you can essentially like schedule. Like my buddy Jonah Greenberger runs a company called Bright that does, it's like Solar City, but in Mexico. And so what they do is they install solar panels because in Mexico electricity prices are very high, and so the incentive to have solar panels is much higher. And so what they try to do, you can't like go door to door to sell solar panels, but so they try to like, they have a, like an SDR motion where they actually set appointments for somebody to go out and then meet with somebody to talk with them about solar panels. Anyway, fascinating. With a $500, the $500 transaction, maybe you could do that. Although on the flip side, maybe somebody wouldn't want to like schedule an appointment to talk about knives. Maybe it's more kind of like those things where those like, this young Jeff guy, he looks like he's down on his luck and, you know, he looks like a good kid. I'll just throw him some cash for these knives.
Oh, I definitely went with the pity script and the sob story. That was one way to endearing yourself into the heart of a prospect.
Love it, man. There's so many people have like grown up like selling Cutco knives. Actually, I'm pretty sure, so Kendall Collins, who used to be the CMO of AppDynamics, and he ran a bunch of parts of Salesforce. He, you know, did product marketing, but then also I think he was like the head of the App Store and a bunch of other stuff as well. But like he always talks about like growing up selling Cutco knives. It's a great experience.
For sure. 16-year-old, young and naive, definitely a way to go. So, hey, Pete, I want to thank you for joining the podcast. Where can
super fun, man.
Yeah, for sure. Where can our listeners find more about you?
Well, I am very easy to find because if you just Google Peter Kazanji, A, you'll probably misspell my last name, but Google will autocorrect it for you. And then the top results will be my LinkedIn profile, my Twitter profile, probably Founding Sales. So those would probably be the easiest ways to find me. If you're interested in early stage go-to-market, check out Founding Sales, my book. It's available online at foundingsales.com. And then the whole text actually of the book is available on the website at foundingsales.com. And if you're in sales operations or sales leadership, you should definitely join Modern Sales. It's just modernsaleshq.com. You can go and sign up for the community.
Well, two telltale signs that you've made it. You either have a Wikipedia page or you're an auto suggest for correction for your last name.
Yeah, I don't know if that's like you made it or like, wow, your last name's weird, man.
I think the former. So, but thanks again, Pete.